Okay, thanks everyone. Welcome to the Arizona State Hospital Independent Oversight Committee. It is February 20th. It is now 6:05 and we're going to begin. I don't think we've met quorum yet. So far from the committee members, we have Janina, myself, Kay, and we're waiting on Chuck to join. Barb texted me that she's going to be calling him from her car. So
Lori, she just joined.
Okay, so we do have Barb. So when Chuck gets on, yep, we will have quorum. We do know that Jane cannot make tonight due to work, and Melissa's on travel, and Dee has resigned due to family issues. So I'll give it one moment, and then we'll go ahead and start. Okay. I am looking for my agenda. So while I start, Larry, do you want to give an update from ADOH?
Sure, I can go ahead and start for you. A couple updates. The annual training for the Law 2000 has been sent out to all the IOC members. So you should have an email in your inbox for that. Please let me know if you have any questions or concerns on that. I can try to get those resolved for you.
Larry?
Yes. Uh-huh.
This is Kay. I don't have my email with you, so I'll need help from the hospital if my children's on the phone. If Tara Morgan can bring the laptop again so I can take the necessary training.
Yep, we'll set it up.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Michael. I'll coordinate that with Tara as well, Kay. Of course. So be on the lookout for that email. And update I have for the group is we are actually working on a recruitment article for the IOCs. And it's going to go into our state newsletter, which will be going out to all state employees, which will hopefully will drive up some interest for the IOCs and increase our recruitment for the committees. So. It looks like Dr. Goldstein just joined too, so you have a quorum.
Oh, good. Thank you.
And we do have another update from ADOA as well. Mm-hmm. Tim, do you want to jump in here?
Well, sure, I can do that. Let me get my camera fired up. So this is Tim Tate. I'm an assistant director at ADOA. For those of you who don't know me, basically I'm here because I'm Larry's boss. So thanks for welcoming me to the meeting. I did want to take a moment to introduce Sarah. She has been hired as the ASH Ombudsman at ADOA, and I'll let her pop in and give her a quick bio, and then I'll describe a little bit about kind of where we go from here. We've hired the person, now what? And so I'll let Sarah introduce herself first.
Hi, good evening, everyone. As my supervisor, Tim, has mentioned, I am the new hire for the position. And basically, my background is I am a social worker, as you are, Ms. Laurie, as I've heard in previous IOC meetings. I do have my master's, and my background runs anywhere from child protective services to behavioral health to trafficking. And I'm excited to be a part of the team and to work with you all.
Excellent. Thanks, Sarah. So from here, we're going to be working on an interagency services agreement. You'll hear it referred to as an ISA. It's basically a memo of understanding between the Department of Administration and the Department of Health Services on how Sarah will interact with the state hospital, what access to information she will have, how she will maintain confidentiality of that information, and the process that she will follow in being the ombudsman. We're still working out exactly what those particulars are, but we're excited to get Sarah started. We have probably a couple of weeks of work ahead of us yet on getting the agreement finalized to define her position and the process that she'll follow. So we've got a little bit of work. We've got to climb a hill here before we can get her working. But we have visited the hospital and met with Mike and his team, and have gotten some insights that are informing how we move forward with developing this process and this agreement with the hospital. And thanks for the opportunity to just briefly give you an overview of that and if it's appropriate, I can take questions if the chair deems that appropriate.
I deem it appropriate.
Thank you, ma'am. Does anybody have any questions about that or any questions for me?
Tim, I do have some questions. This is Kay. I was wondering, will the patients here at ASH have access to Sarah in the similar fashion that they have already to the patient's right advocate here at the hospital?
No. And one of our reasons for that is we don't want to duplicate things that are already established at the hospital. So Sarah will engage kind of on two different fronts. She's going to engage on the complaint and grievance process. And she's also going to engage on kind of a more holistic level, looking at policies, procedures that cover the facility, and looking at ways to make recommendations and move initiatives forward on that level as well. So she'll be engaged in the grievance process and at looking at kind of the broader picture. But she won't be a direct pipeline for patients. Now, she'll have access to patients as part of her work, but we won't be like distributing her phone number and email address to patients, no.
Hey, I was just reading the Arizona Department of Administration Ombudsman job summary, and it said this is an exciting opportunity that allows you to be a voice for the patients, family, staff, and ensuring their concerns are heard, reviewed, and resolved. So I'm a little bit confused as to the job description and what you're describing to me.
Yeah, I think Sarah's role will become more clear as we get the agreement finalized. I think what's important, though, is that she will be involved in the complaint and grievance process. She'll have access to 100% of the complaints and grievances, and she will review those that that she deems necessary to review. She'll review cases that are of interest to her and of interest to the hospital. She'll take an interest in meeting with the patients on occasion when she needs to get more information, deeper insights, to find out additional information to suit her reporting needs. And it's important that Sarah maintain sort of a keen voice for the hospital and of the hospital, but at the same time remain independent. So Sarah's going to be going through some training with the hospital staff, some of the new employee orientation modules. Part of that is there's sort of two reasons for that. One is to get her kind of acclimated to the environment, and that's for the safety of the patients and her safety, and just understanding how the environment operates. The second one is to get a little bit of the philosophy, understanding the philosophy for how the hospital operates. But I think her role will become more clear as we engage in all of this. But Sarah she's a social worker, I'm not, which is really, it's kind of odd, but Sarah's gonna really help us to define what this role does and what it means for the patients at the hospital.
Okay, any other questions for Sarah or Tim? Well, welcome, Sarah. And
can I ask a question to the person?
No, this is, you can talk during public comment, but only committee members can speak during the session. Sorry.
Okay, thank you.
I'm sorry.
I have another question for Tim. How is she different from what we, so we currently have grievances and patients' right advocates here at the hospital, and I was wondering, like, we can appeal it to ACTIS and an outside third party persons already, so how will Sarah's role differ from that?
So as I understand it, and I'm not an expert in the process, I don't know if you could define ACTIS as an independent reviewer. They're kind of part of the treatment team, right? So Sarah is going to be coming at this, I think, with a different perspective. She's going to be looking at these issues with a different lens and coming at it with a different set of experiences. She's not part of the treatment team. She's not part of the hospital staff. She's not part of the grievance process per se. She's setting outside of all of that. And I think that's important that she maintains that independence. That's why we're involved in this at all. That's why the Department of Administration is involved in this, was because the governor's office was really clear on making sure that Sarah had independence. And so that's why this position's landed where it has. It might seem like kind of an odd fit, but I think that separation is really important to give Sarah the latitude that she needs and the patients the support they deserve.
Will Sarah be directly reporting to you and then you to Governor Hobbs? Is that how that works?
So Sarah reports to me, that's correct. I report to the director of the Department of Administration and the director reports to the governor.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, ma'am, happy to help.
Any other questions for Tim or Sarah? With that being said, I'm gonna go back and follow the protocol. Welcome. Does anyone have a disclosure of conflict of interest? And if so, please state it and also submit your conflict in writing and send it in to Larry. Any conflicts of interest? Okay. Well, is the committee able to review the meeting minutes sent out by Larry for last month? And if so, do I have a motion to approve?
Motion to approve the minutes from last month.
Chuck, if you're talking, you're muted.
I second.
Sorry about that. Second.
Okay, so Jania is second. All in favor? Aye. Any opposed?
Aye.
Okay. The meetings are approved. We just heard our update from ADOA. Again, we'll emphasize, and I'm no example because I haven't done my training yet, but I will. For those, I know I've been asked, I think Kim was looking for it and couldn't find it. I told her off the top of my head, I knew it was from admin at ADOA to look for it. And if the link does expire, so it will be expiring shortly. Larry, will you be sending out another link for those of us that didn't get it done?
Yes. Yes, I'll come on to that for you and get that out for you guys.
Okay.
So I will say that I tried to access this and fill it out, but was unable to do so. So I'm not sure why. I'm not sure why it was so difficult to get to this
link.
Yeah, but when I got to the link, it took me to some corporation. I think it was Tactic or something. Just be advised, Larry, that at least that first link, I was following the step by step. And I got to a step that said, now click on library or something like that, but there was no button to click on, so it just didn't work. So you might look into that.
Okay. I'll look into getting some clear step-by-step instructions on that for you guys.
Okay.
Great.
I'll try also. Do we have any other IOCs on here? And if so, do they have any updates? Okay. Before we have review of action items and follow-up. So we did have two items that we talked about in executive session that we sent ahead. One was we wanted a motion to more concisely the hospital provide us with their process for recovering funds from patients that have the means and funds and exactly what that entails, how they go about informing the patients on what they are doing. The reason why this is so important is that we do have an ongoing patient allegation that the hospital steals their checks, and whenever they deposit them in the bank, that their money is swept. So we were hoping that we could get this information, and Mike did send it. I got it, and I sent it out to the committee on what the procedures are for. There are a couple. First, the first one is payer financials. So the Arizona Department of Health Services fills out this information where the person, the patient, has to answer who their payee is and if they receive or expect money to receive from any of the following: tribal money, Social Security, supplemental security, workers' comp, industrial, retirement pension, veterans, spousal. And they have to release information on checking amount, savings account, current market value of stocks, bonds, mutuals, and other, and have to disclose if they have court fees, child support, department support, education, fiduciary fees, and they have to prove with documentation what they're saying is true. Then there's another paper that I assume, and Larry, you can correct, not Larry, but Mike, you can correct me when I'm done. Assignment of benefits. I know that as a personal person that uses my insurance, when I go to a doctor and they have me sign this information that you assign insurance benefits in financial form. So if your insurance is going to pay and you don't pay, when that check comes to you, if it doesn't go directly to the provider, you have to pay the provider that money that you received from the insurance. Basically, it's the same kind of form. So it's assignment of benefits, financial responsibility, release of information. I assume that the patient or their guardian or their payee sign this for every patient that's at ASH. Is that correct, Mike?
Yeah, Lori, that's part of the admission process.
So it may be that people forget because when they're checking into a hospital, maybe they're overwhelmed by so many things that they forget that they signed this, and that could be some of the confusion. And then we also got a nice explanation of how does the hospital determine what to charge for fees, and that was Arizona State Hospital Department of Health Services, and it talks about what their fees are. So they did provide information that we asked for on so we could help clarify. And I think Tara's on, now Sarah's on, and Trevor, that the patient that alleges that the hospital is stealing their money, if it is indeed recouping benefits and insurance that they're entitled to, that this patient be that this is explained to them at the detail at the level that they can understand it. So they understand the hospital is not stealing their money. They're just collecting money that's owed to them.
I was wondering, I don't know whose responsibility it is, but maybe we can show this patient that's making those allegations the signed form so that they understand that those checks do belong to ASH.
Lori, if you want to have that conversation offline,
okay,
with the details, then I can get with social work and have those forms presented.
Okay, that sounds great. The other thing that we asked, and I'm not sure if it came through. I don't think I saw it. We wanted to provide noise canceling headphones and blue light glasses that are approved and on the list. So that we know and the patients know, the ones that may suffer from input overload or are on the spectrum or have issues, that they know which ones are approved so they don't buy ones that aren't approved. And if they have the right glasses, they know which ones to buy so they're not confiscated. I don't think we got that. So
I wasn't able to give you exactly that, Lori. So what I did was actually go way overboard, and I just uploaded the entire catalog to the directory for you to take a look at. I want to say like page, it's like a 300 page catalog, so you know, have fun perusing. But I want to say it's like page like 267, something like that, is where the headphones are. And there's no there is a section on there for eyeglasses and sunglasses. I didn't see anything that says like blue filter on there, but I would consider, you know, those glasses, if they're using it for looking at the computer screen or whatever it is, as long as if the patient wants to work with the social work team to buy a pair of blue light filter glasses, as long as they're not metal or they're unsafe for another reason, we would allow the patient to wear those glasses.
Okay, so if they're in the catalog, they're approved?
Yes and no. So there are some things in that catalog that we still do not allow because they have like there's a couple pairs of headphones that have metal headbands that we don't allow them to use. But by and large, a good percentage of those things are greenlit.
Mike, is this the Walking Horse catalog?
Yeah.
Okay. I'll let that patient know. And then as long as the treatment team knows here on the unit that the patient's on, maybe we can get that worked out.
Yeah, Trevor and Tara will follow up, make sure that's all taken care of.
Okay, thank you.
And, yeah, I apologize for not sending that out. I was forwarding the documents to the committee late, so you would have it in time yesterday, so you'd have time to peruse it today. And the catalog was too big to send, so I'm going to have to download it, upload it to a place where I can send the link.
Lori, I have a copy of that catalog. I order through them, so I have a copy. I can just look and I can show the patient that catalog as well.
Okay. But for the committee members, I will get it to a place where I can share the link so you can peruse it if you'd like. Staffing concerns, we also heard in patient calls that there were concerns that staffing levels were low. It was alleged that certain units were not being permitted to go and to have any outside time due to low staffing census, and that they need at least two people out with the unit, and they didn't have enough people to have two out and enough in. So the allegation was that people were not allowed out for a long period of time, days.
So yeah, I do not believe that is accurate. I was aware of this this accusation. I did pull some random video footage of the forensic hospital and saw the patients out and about on their patios. I will say that the person who made that statement is correct, though. We do need two staff available, at least observing, because of it's required that if there is an incident, we need to have two staff available to respond to the incident and potentially go hands-on with the patient. We cannot do a one-on-one physical hold of a patient. So if they have exact like days or times that they want us to take a look at, we'll happily do so. But unless the unit was on some kind of a quarantine for a sickness, then they would have had access to their patio.
Mike, we've been having some issues with staffing. Cottonwood specific unit had two techs and one nurse on a Saturday. And so obviously, like with only two techs, you can't have those two techs go to patio and have nobody on the floor. Like, right. And also like other units are suffering too. We've been dealing with having maybe even just three techs, and even then that we can't meet the two, because one person has to watch the hallway and then two people go out to patio. Who's getting hygiene and lunch and, you know, all the other needs that need to be met? Like it's kind of like in a gridlock, because with the two personnel requirement out there, we can't make it. Like, I mean, it's very rare that we get four techs on our unit.
Okay, let me ask around, see what's going on. I know we have weekends for us have been difficult lately, to say the least. We've had some staff calling off due to illnesses, and then our registry staff don't like to work on weekends necessarily, so it's difficult for us to get them in. But Trevor and Tara are taking some notes. I'll talk with nursing tomorrow to see what exactly is going on.
Is there any way we can modify the policy instead of having two personnel out there, having 1 to 5 or something like that? And then as long as there's less than 5 people out on patio, we can do it with 1, because making it 2 is, because I'm out here on, you know, the ground level, and it's almost impossible to meet those meet those requirements?
I can't answer that right now because that's more than just patients using the patio. That's essentially our entire safety protocol right there. So let me have some conversations, Kay, see what we can do to help out a little bit more. Maybe we'll need to flex some rehab folks over there to help with coverage.
And it's not just Cottonwood. There's other units that are having, they're not getting as much patio time as they would like. I mean, some is good, but like some patients are used to being out there most of the day, and it's getting basically cut down because of the staffing issue.
Okay.
Or the policy, it's a combination of policy staffing.
Okay.
Yeah, it may be interesting to consider, instead of making sure that, I mean, it'd be great to have enough staff all the time on every unit, full-time employees, but it may be worth considering to hire some people that are just staff for outside, at least one. So the units will only have to send one, and you have one person that their job is to be outside all the time.
There's things that we could possibly do. I mean, that it may be something like having security guards more present in the outside area to assist. So let me kick some ideas around.
Okay, thank you.
And I was also thinking that if you could hire like a couple security guards to just watch the mall and open the mall from maybe 3 to 5 instead of, you know, just 4 to 5, but just opening it up from 3 to 5 with security staff out there, I think that a lot of patients would be even happy with that. So then that way it's not a 2-person per unit burden. It could just be like, you know, 3 or 4 security staff watching the mall.
Yeah, there's options. We'll take a look into this.
Tara?
Thank you. I just want to comment to that. We have rovers here at the hospital, and oftentimes the units use the rovers to come and supplicate. So when there's an issue where we have to move staff a certain area to cover certain issues, certain places, whether it's pop run, whether it's on the mall, whether it's on patio, we utilize rovers. So we do have rovers here, but sometimes on forensic, due to the staffing, the rovers have to come into the acuity, but that does not mean that they're not still doing rover work. They're helping out and they're assisting. So, Kay, I'm going to come over and see you this week coming in. I already put your name down, okay? And then you can explain to me what you were trying to ask here.
Okay, it's just that, like, a lot of times what I've witnessed is that we wind up having 2 to 3 techs on any given day. And to meet that 2-tech requirement to go out to patio means that one sole person left on the unit, which actually leaves that person at danger because, you know, they're just one single person in the hallway. Like, it's just, and then they're having to do census and then get hygiene, and it's kind of an impossible task.
Okay, well, hopefully you guys, Tara, you can follow up, and Mike, you can look at some possible solutions. Next, we are at, I think that was the 2 areas that we had voted on and we wanted to follow up on. Do we have an ASH admin update? I think we have good news.
Yeah. So the one update that I do have is good news. I'm very happy to announce to the group that Dr. Stephen Kuo has been officially appointed to the role of the hospital's chief medical officer. So Dr. Kuo is on the line right now. He's been in an acting capacity for approximately 8 months. He's been with the hospital for just under 11 years. So very happy to have him taking over as the CMO. And he has some good ideas for ways to improve the workforce at the hospital, look at some different practices that we could potentially adopt in the future, funding permitting, and then really working with the outpatient systems and the health plans to further integrate the hospital into the larger state care continuum. So very happy to have him on board. We also did identify the individual who's going to be our new director of HR at the hospital, and that person starts in about 2 weeks on the 10th.
That's great news. Welcome, Dr. Kuo.
Thank you so much.
Congratulations.
Thanks, Kay.
So let's go to patient visits and I'll do overview and incident and accident. So sadly, you're going to have to listen to me because Melissa and Dee did patient visits this month. Dee, again, has resigned and Melissa is on work travel. So one patient was alleging that staff are playing cards and no patients when no patients eating on floor. So I'm just reading it, so I can't explain anything, but that was the allegation. Another one, patient was ROU'd for public information request to see if there were violations on a certain staff person. So that was concerning when I talked to Melissa. If indeed true, that if someone does a public information request, that they should not have punitive action related to just asking for information. Let's see. Another was waiting on a call from attorney. And the other day, the staff missed 6 calls from the attorney. The staff does not answer the calls. I can tell you later, Mike, in what unit this is. Patient was told by staff they would lose games for a month, but treatment team is the one that has to determine whether a patient loses games. I'm not sure what games, maybe video or other, but they were upset that it shouldn't be a particular staff member, but the treatment team. Same person, family called and went to the nurse's station. No one told the patient. Another one, unable to do paperwork or access their data. Also received mail, but it was already opened. We've gone through this before. Doesn't the hospital look at the mail to make sure there's no contraband coming in or drugs?
It goes through our scanner, and then if we have a concern based on what was in the x-ray, then we will look at it just to verify that there is anything in there contraband. Safety issue.
Okay. Another was that the patient alleged they were dropped 2 levels with no explanation. I would hope and think both Dr. Kuo and Michael Sheldon and others that if someone's losing levels, there is a explanation and with the treatment team of here's what you did, here's why you're losing it, here's what you need to do to gain it back.
Yes.
Okay. Also, this patient thinks it's not a coincidence that when a certain staff returned from vacation, that drugs were in the hospital. Now, again, this is an allegation. We have no way to. I'm just reporting what I was given. Only supportive person on their unit is a nurse on their treatment team who is a male nurse. Another one said that someone took the patient's clothes and patient did not receive the inventory list. So again, saying that certain clothing was removed and they didn't see that on an inventory list. So maybe making sure that they were taking this for whatever reason, whether it's too many or whether it fails one of the restrictions and that the patient see it at the time. So that was one patient, and the other patient said that on a previous Friday, there was a memo stating that staff need to be in a room when doing a video visitation. And they were concerned that they feel that they're supposed to have privacy for video, phone, and mail, and that they don't think that a person should be in the room when they have a video visit with family or approved others. So is that a policy?
So it is right now to have somebody in the room. And the reason for that is we had a video visit taking place. Oh, geez, probably it was about 3 weeks ago. It was since the last time this group met. And we had concerns that the patient was attempting to access the internet outside of doing more than just the video meeting. So we did confirm that it did not have any kind of issues actually taking place, but just the fact that that was an option made us rethink how we use video visits. Video visits really came to fruition during the pandemic. Anyway, so what we're doing instead right now, we are going to be getting some iPads from health services downtown, and those mm-hmm. iPads are going to be re-imaged, and then they're going to be essentially locked down so that the only thing that they can do is video conferencing, and then each forensic unit will be given one of those iPads. And then that will not require the staff to be in the room.
Okay. Is that the same on the civil side too?
Civil will have that option. Civil does not have anywhere near the level of visits that forensics does. So that's really our focus right now, is to get that taken care of over there. But yes, they'll have that to their availability as well.
Mike, is there any way possible that we can have the staff members sit outside of the window so then there's a little bit of privacy? Because I don't know all of the laws, but I've read some of them, and I know that we have the right to a private conversation, and I know that patients feel that it's pretty intrusive. And the other thing that kind of sucks about this is that, you know, like, one person always ruins it for everybody, and we wind up getting these blanketed policies that just hurt everybody. I was wondering, would we be able to have the staff member wait outside of the window? Do you know what I'm talking about?
I do. Trevor, we discussed that as one of the options. Do you remember why?
Yeah, so some of the units utilize a desktop, while other units utilize a laptop. The ones with the laptops are the ones that give us the biggest problems, because we can't see the screen. Because they can be moved, whereas the desktop are stationary. And I think that was the reason this call was made.
Can we just make it so that, you know, the patient can't move the laptop, and that's just known, and then the staff member waits outside, and if the patient touches the laptop, then their video visit ends or something?
Let me talk to nursing tomorrow about that. Okay, we're already, I mean, just given what you said a second ago about staffing levels, I don't want to put too much on them right now, but let me see what we can do.
They're already having to sit with us during the video visits. Right. Like, so regardless, you're already losing a person right. for the visit either way.
You know, and I'm trying to meet everybody in the middle. My initial reaction was to get rid of video visits, period, until we have those iPads. So I try to meet in the middle, but let me see what else I can do for you all.
Okay, well, thank
there
you.
Is, yeah.
It's just, I know some patients feel it's intrusive. That's all.
I can also say that there are software solutions to this. So anyone that's taken an online higher education class, there is software that when you're taking a class or a test, nothing can open. You can't open anything else other than the one browser that you're using. So that may be a cheaper option for you guys rather than using a person to sit and do it, just buying the software. I can try to find out the name of that software.
Yeah, if you that'd be fine. I don't want to make a huge investment knowing the fact that we already have these iPads lined up that are going to be locked down. But yeah, any information will definitely take a look at it.
Back to the patient. They were reporting that everything on their new unit is fine. They're not getting targeted. They feel the staff is nice. They're accommodating. They are very relieved that after a long period of time, they feel at ease and peace, and they no longer feel dread. They feel that the medication is correct, and they're symptoms are under control. They also reported something that we discussed last month, which had to do with a situation about strip search. And a lot of the peers felt, a lot of the patients felt that that was intrusive. Now, I think we talked about that before. it wasn't done lightly, but I think some patients had either tested positive or had symptoms that were positive for drugs. And that's when the order came. And I think it was a medical order that they were to be searched. I think the patients felt that they didn't like it, that there were more people in the room. And that's understandable. It would be awkward. So that was a complaint, but we did discuss that last month. Patient was also put on medical ROU due to a test. And while they were on ROU, they were not allowed to give someone else money for a pop run or use computer. And they wondered why, for a medical ROU, why they would be punished against pop runs and computer use and others. Off of that, that was good. There was another patient that wanted to meet with the IOC, but they also wanted us to meet with their lawyer present. And I don't think that's appropriate because we're not legal counsel and we're not permitted under the guidelines to just advocate for one person, but the community, for the patients in general, for rules that affect everyone, whether their safety, violation of private rights, but not going with someone to meet with their attorney. So I hope, you know, and it's open for discussion, but that was what we felt as the IOC.
I would defer to the folks at ADOA about that.
Lori, I would agree with that. That's the right call.
Okay. So if the patient wants to visit with us, fine, but we are not going to partake in a patient lawyer IOC visit. I don't think it's appropriate. Okay. So now we're on to incident and accident report. First one was ASH 2025-0003. It was a self-abuse, self-injury, significant physical changes or findings. The patient was on COS, LOS. And while she was, the patient was on this, they went into the restroom. And when they went into the restroom, now I don't know how that works. If someone's on COS and LOS, this is out of my own ignorance. Are they supposed to go into the restroom with them? I don't know.
Trevor, Dr. Quo, jump in on this, but my response is going to be, it depends on the doctor's orders. There's some COSs, LOSs, close observation, line of sight, where it's only applicable like overnight when the patient is sleeping or something like that. It's different.
Yeah, it depends. If, for example, they're suicidal and they're on COS high risk, they have to be within our policy within 6 feet. So if they do something to self-harm, there's somebody to assist. And unfortunately, that does include all times. Sometimes you do see self-harm in the bathroom where they use that as their way to, find time to do that. So yeah, this is, we try our best to match, genders. But often it is in the bathroom, showering. They have to be witnessed. It is an order that's given, and obviously the staff don't want to violate that order, since their job would be at risk if they don't. So.
Okay.
So, Lori, what I've seen of COS LOS is that they normally prop the door open.
Okay. And I'm not sure, because it doesn't go into as much detail. It does say that the person was not watching the person, the provider, whoever her tech was not watching the person. And that person took a strap from their croc shoe and swallowed it, which led to ER visit. And in nursing, it talked about, you know, the things that led to it, which are bathroom does not lock, therefore the patient was able to enter. But I think if they are on that LOS or COS, the person watching would know that. The tech didn't report no hallway person was there to spot them while they watched the patient inside the bathroom. So therefore, I think the tech felt that they couldn't leave and go in the bathroom, which, and also it looks like they felt compromised in watching a female patient, a different gender patient in the restroom. So there were a couple issues going on. The tech involved was a registry tech. Core staff are more aware of what is required in situations like that. There was a work order to repair the lock so the person can't go in without a tech unlocking. And if once that was done, the staff can call on the radio to get a second staff member there before opening a bathroom door. And charge nurses can assign more experienced registry techs to do the one-on-ones, especially with people who have had recent self-harming behaviors. So that one was a little unusual.
That person is no longer with the hospital.
Oh, okay. Okay. The next one was just a question. It was asked 2025-0028. And there was a code. There were two patients. When one came up behind another one and punched the other one in the face unprovoked, when the other one tried to defend themselves, the staff separated, which is appropriate, put them in brief holds and escorted one to the seclusion room. In the social worker notes, they said in incident reviewed, so-and-so should not have been placed in seclusion since it was written that they assaulted so-and-so. Why was the other one secluded? So it seems like the one that was the aggressor did not get secluded, but the person that was the victim got secluded. So when that happens, do they apologize to the person? I mean, what happens?
Well, that instance, you know, I think it's a matter of subjectivity. You know, you get somebody yelling, somebody assaults that, you know, and like who started it, right? So there's a little bit of that, I think. When you're living on a unit with 20 other patients day after day, you know, drama builds up. It seems to have calmed a bit, but, you know, even within staff, there's subjectivity on quote unquote who started it. But, you know, we try to solve the physical aggressor in that moment first. You know, there's, you know, how come, you know, they weren't punished, you know, so it's a little tit for tat, but I think on the unit, the psychological issues are hopefully being resolved so that doesn't happen in the future.
Thank you. Trevor?
I just want to point out as well that on this particular incident, while that individual was taken into seclusion, that seclusion door was never shut. They were taken in there as a moment to debrief, and they could have exited at any time. It was just a means to separate the individuals. And so the individual who did go in was still, even though they were defending themselves, were verbally being aggressive, and that's why they escorted her or them into that area.
Okay. The next one was just a question on maybe the way it was tagged. It's 2025-0226. The allegation is actual or threat of legal action, assault, all of their types, injuries to patients, staffs, visitors, patients threatening other patients, seclusion or restraint. I didn't see anywhere where this was actual or threat of legal action. So unless I'm missing it. So I just think that's a correction, unless I'm missing it, Trevor.
Yes. What happened is, so the staff get to select the type of incident they believe they are. And then my team on the back end, which unfortunately you don't see at the front, is what we actually code it as. And so this was not coded as an actual or a threat of legal action. It was just one of the options the staff who filled out the IR selected.
Okay. That's what it seemed like to me. Like it was just tagged wrong. Okay. We just have another two. This one was Ash 2025-0265, attempted suicide, significant physical changes. This one, a patient, wrapped a cord around their neck. And I know that we've had similar incidents in the last few months. I don't know. So I don't know if it's the same person that
it is.
That's had the same, but yeah. So to me, was it really a suicide or was it DTS or,
I mean, I think this is one of those things that we would classify as a suicidal gesture, not a suicidal act or an attempt, but our system does not have a suicidal gesture category that we can use, unfortunately. We are working to upgrade our system in the future, and that's one of the things we want to consider or, you know, adopt to get our coding a little bit more succinct. But yeah, this is that same individual, this is their behavioral pattern.
Yeah, and it did say when they reviewed it, the person, the social worker, was concerned that the person is on a 2-to-1, and they believe, the social worker believes they should be right with the person when they start to run inside. They were running from a hallway to a patio, into a hallway from a patio, and they felt that her 2-on-1s should keep up, I think, is the message there.
Yeah, and I can tell you that by reviewing the video footage, that the 2-to-1 staff were maybe two steps behind this individual. They were right there.
Okay. The other one was 20250305, and it was an assault, patient refusing redirection, patient threatening other patient. And while everything occurred, one thing I wanted to bring up, which is a good thing, was when the video was reviewed, no quality of care concerns, and staff did an outstanding job. So you don't see that often, but they actually took time to note that in the IR. So I thought, you don't always want to hear me telling you everything bad. Here was something that was noted that was good. And that was it for incident and accident and patient. So with that, you know, Larry, what I forgot to put on here? I forgot to put public comment, but they still do get public comment even if I mess up the agenda, right?
That's a good question. Let me, I'm sorry, I had to reboot my computer and I lost the agenda, so let me pull that up again.
I'm pulling up my notes. I didn't pull up yours, so maybe you caught me and put it in there.
Normally, I do put it in there as a standing item.
I see under C10, it says call to the public. My version of it has it.
Oh, good.
Whew. Oh, good.
Thanks.
Okay.
Thanks, Larry. Dodged the bullet. And before we go to calls to the public, I didn't put anything down for an executive meeting. I believe. I don't think we have anything to discuss unless we discuss.
My version for executive session. Go ahead.
I got something for 7:30 to 8 for an executive session. And I was like, huh?
Yeah.
And that's okay if there's a reason for it. But when I sent my agenda out, I didn't have a reason. So.
Lori,
we have a reason.
Yeah, Lori, I left that as a standing item for you in the committee, because I know in the course of the meeting, sometimes things come up and you want to do a deeper dive. So I left that in there for you.
Thank you.
And the other And Barb, the other link was to, I wanted to have a standing executive session link for the committee. So it's one constant link. So you're not getting different links at different times. So it just makes it a little bit easier to, for your calendar.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Of course.
Okay, so before we go off to public comment, does anyone on the committee have anything they'd like to bring up? Any concerns on what they've heard, incident accidents, or patient?
I have some comments. I thought that, and we don't have to do it at this IOC meeting, we can do it in the future one, but we're talking about potentially the legal rights of some of the patients here and the different statutes that apply to us, and I was wondering if we're going to have that discussion.
I think that what we talked about was, we think it would be a good idea. I would love to get a mental health judge or someone that isn't currently involved with any patients at ASH to talk about what about plea agreements and what they actually mean, because I think that we've talked about this before, and I have asked other judges and federal judges, when there are plea changes, if someone was told, you know, if their presumed sentence would be, I'm throwing it out there, 10 years, and if their lawyer or anyone tells them, if you take this plea, you'll only serve a year or two. My friend, who's a federal judge, says that would never happen. Ask them to listen to their court recordings. Because whenever there's a plea change, the judges are very clear. Has anyone told you anything other than what I'm telling you your sentence will be, even if you're serving it in another place? But I think there's confusion with language that said within X amount of time, you're going to be examined to see if you're at stable remission or a risk to the community. So those subtleties, which I don't know. So if I can find someone to do it, we would have an educational session, unless anyone here knows someone.
I have the ARS statutes in front of me, and 13-3994 clearly states, the person under the jurisdiction of the Superior Court hearing mental health report, risk assessment, conditional release, hearings, and decisions. A person who is placed under the jurisdiction of the Superior Court pursuant to this section is not eligible for discharge from the jurisdiction until the date set by the court. So basically, we're under the jurisdiction of the Superior Court. So we're not sentenced to ASH. We're sentenced under the jurisdiction of the Superior Court. And so subsection B says a secure mental health facility may request a hearing pursuant to section. And so it goes on to give us these following subsections in section B1. So there's four different basic criteria that like we can fall under and the corresponding outcome to us once we've been adjudicated GEI. And the first one is if the court finds that the person still has a mental disease or defect and is dangerous, the court shall order that the person remain committed at the secure mental health facility. So if you're still, if you still have a mental disease or defect and you're dangerous, you're still here at ASH. The second one is if the court finds that the person no longer needs ongoing treatment for mental health disease or defect and is not dangerous, the court shall place the person on supervised probation for the remainder of the commitment imposed pursuant to section 13502 subsection D. So this one's basically saying that if you no longer suffer from a mental disease or if you have a personality disorder and you no longer need treatment and you're not dangerous, that you serve the rest of your quote unquote sentence under probation. Subsection 3 says, if the court finds that the person still has a mental disease or defect, or that the mental disease or defect is in stable remission, and the person is no longer dangerous, the court shall order the person's conditional release. This person shall remain under the court's jurisdiction, which is what we're currently under. We're under the court's jurisdiction. We're not sentenced to ASH. And so, like, I have, and then there's the last one, is if the person has been sentenced pursuant to subsection 13704, 13710, or 13751, subsection A, the court finds that the person no longer needs ongoing treatment for a mental disease or defect, and the person is dangerous, the court shall impose the sentence and order the person to be transferred to the state's Department of Corrections for the remainder of the commitment term. All time spent under the court's jurisdiction and any time spent committed pursuant to this section shall be credited against any sentence imposed. So basically, if you no longer have a mental disease or defect and you're still found dangerous, you can serve the rest of your time out in DOC. So my bigger question is, like, and some of these things are defined. So when we took our plea agreement, we got a DEI sentence, which means we're not sentenced to ASH. We're sentenced under the jurisdiction of the Superior Court, and the Superior Court is acting ASH to figure out which one of these four categories we fall under. And conditional release is not something that's just willy-nilly. It's been legally defined in section 13-3991. The first section says conditional release means release from a secure mental health facility under written specified written conditions. The term dangerous means a danger of inflicting serious physical harm on oneself or others, including attempted suicide or the serious threat of suicide. If the threat is such that when considered in the light of the threat's context or previous act, the threat is substantially supportive of an expectation that it will be carried out. So I'm sorry.
I just think that while the statutes say that, I think that mental health judges in Superior Court are not clinicians, so they are going to ask that clinical team, ASH, what they think. Now, I do think that, as witnessed by unfortunate failures on early release, and sometimes it's not for their mental health disease, but for other conditions, maybe drugs or whatever, that they work their program, they get to the point where the clinicians and the team say they're ready for release, they release them. And when they fail in the community, I think the courts start getting a little more hesitant and want more. They want to be guaranteed that there's public safety. So there's two parts. There is a patient's rights and there's a security.
Right.
I know. And I agree with Mike. We're not lawyers, so we cannot.
I'm not a lawyer. Yeah. I'm just reading what our rights are, and I guess I'm just having a hard time understanding some of. I understand that the hospital is in a difficult situation, but I think that, like, when things like stable remission or non-dangerousness, like, I mean, the hospital needs to start looking at the criteria, because, like, we're not supposed to be warehoused here. That's not the point to this. And they have to do their best and use their best judgment on who to release and who not to release. But at the same time, like, you know, our rights are being violated on some level. And it's just like, I don't understand who we go to, other than maybe our attorneys, but, you know, like, it's hard because a lot of the places trust that the hospital is trying to progress this as quickly as possible. And I feel that sometimes that's not true.
Well, again, like, if I can get someone from a mental health court to come talk and talk about their process, what they look at.
And would help, because she's been a member of this this forum before, would she be willing to I can try and address her and have her come and talk about these different statutes, because I believe it was Jack Potts and Holly Giesel that put some of these into law because of sometimes of the warehousing that happens here.
I think Jack is a forensic psychiatrist and probably was involved with the creation of some of these. I was trying to go ahead.
I just wanted to say, if you can have anybody at all, throw some sort of clarification on to how these statutes are interpreted by the court, by the mental health judge. I would imagine if we could get a mental health judge, that would be
that's what I want.
Most appropriate person, because lawyers, you're not going to get the nuance of what a mental health judge thinks about when he's thinking about somebody who is under the court's jurisdiction, who is now in Arizona State Hospital under a GEI, I guess, plea arrangement. I'm not sure it's actually a plea arrangement, but that's the way you've described it, but has been adjudged to be GEI and is now at Arizona State Hospital. You want to know what's going through the mind of the judge. I think I have a pretty good idea, but I'm not even willing to voice what my opinion is here, because this should be something that you actually have somebody who's doing the work, a mental health judge. If you're going to give any kind of educational review at all,
I believe that there's two judges, one in Maricopa County and one in Pima County, that's actually handling our cases and looking at these statutes. I can try and find the names of both of those judges, and if you want to reach out to them, like, we can try and do that.
I think that's a good idea.
Yeah, because I think, as Chuck said, he went to law school too. There is nuance, and if someone, it's their job and that's what they're doing, they have a different view on the public safety and what it all means.
Yeah. I mean, the judges have to take into account, of course, what the law says, what the statute, but the way that judges interpret things is different quite a bit from one judge to another.
And I agree with you, but we also have to remember that each case is unique. So I think it will be a little bit challenging for a judge to give a blanket answer.
Well, they can tell us the factors they consider.
I'm not saying a blanket answer. I'm saying if we got a mental health judge to actually give some sort of talk on this, talking about how he interprets the law and his views on this from his own point of view.
Or her.
I think, go ahead.
I said that would be a very interesting education session.
Okay. I will hear as well, just because, like, you know, some of us are wondering, you know, and quite a few of us are wondering, you know, the process and because the laws kind of give us hope. And so when we look to these, we're like, how is this not applied to us? And why is it taking so long? And those types of questions. And so, like, I think it would be helpful if we could, and I'll find out what the judges' names are, unless, Mike, you know them, in Pima County and Maricopa County, that I can ask around. Wealthy is in Maricopa County. Judge Welty, is it W-E-L-T-Y? Judge Welty is in Maricopa, and I think Pima County is getting a new judge. I've heard that judge is retiring, so we'll have to find out who the new judge in Pima County is.
And again, if we get a judge as an educational, we're not going to have them talk about specific cases. It would be, here is in general what we're looking at, and here's what a plea agreement means.
What he is looking at.
He or she.
I mean, you're not going to get a judge, as Janina was saying, to say this is the general way that all judges that do mental health interpret these statutes. I imagine it's interpreted from judge to judge and from, as Janina said, from individual case to individual case. It would have to be.
Michael?
Hi, Lori. Thanks. But before we break off in a public comment, if the IOC does opt to reach out to a judge and he or she is willing to come and present, I would just ask that takes place in executive session, if possible. I don't want the hospital to be on the phone when that happens, because we are a party in these cases. So I don't want to give any kind of, you know, look that we're working against outside of the scope of our statute.
Okay.
Nothing's fair.
Okay. Well, thank you. Anything else before we go to public comment? Okay. Okay, anyone from the public would like to comment?
This is John Wallace on Sycamore.
Hey, John.
Can you hear me? Hi.
Yes.
You know, I've been listening to these meetings a long time. I can't go into specifics about any one case, but generally, the problems I've had in my situation is that I grew up in a country called the United States of America. I was raised by people who fought for this country and worked to make our community safe, law enforcement, military, and just farmers. And I believed I had these rights until I had to defend myself and became an embarrassment to law enforcement. I've actually been told by an officer of the court that I didn't have enough money to obtain my rights under the law. How two doctors can tell the court that I have a history of violence, drug addiction, and alcoholism when I don't, and nobody seems to care, bothers me deeply. The hospital is designed so that three people can maintain safety on the units. One person stationed at the nurse's station monitors can see the entire hospital grounds and living space through the cameras and through the windows in the nurse's station, with two people on the floor as rovers for safety and service providers. Three people can keep the entire living space as safe as possible. Anything else is just extraneous. The doors to the patio, the patios are an extension of the living space, and the patient should have access to that space unfettered. The day rooms often become chaotic, and it would be nice to just step outside. We used to be able to. Anyway, the vocational and educational program is supposed to help us develop skills relevant to our vocation and our educational desires and pursuits. It's been very difficult. I hope we can make progress on that. When I agreed to come to this hospital, I was told that I'd be able to publish my work, that there were internet-connected computers on every unit. To take those away because a patient misbehaved, to take away my art supplies and my access to education because another patient misbehaved, to take away my writing utensils, something I've had since I was 2 years old, because someone else hurt someone. That is the definition of discrimination, prejudice against me because I'm labeled as mentally ill. It is that automatic bias, that blanket prejudice that is unlawful. And the conduct of the staff at this facility has been abhorrent towards people like me who are advocating for our rights. I have been tortured. I have been denied medical care. I have been refused access to education. I have been refused my right to work in my vocation. Tortured for advocating. And I mean that physically, psychologically tortured by doctors, nurses, and their staff.
Oh, sure. John, sorry, your 3 minutes are up.
Well, to end then, please, one more second. I was told by my grandfather, judges give too much credibility to the opinions of doctors. In my case, no lawyer has asked any doctor to demonstrate their opinions, and they should have. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have anyone else from the public?
Yeah, this is Tim Briscoe on Sego.
Hi, Tim.
Hi, you guys touched on a few things. Yes, I'm on a better unit. I don't feel targeted anymore. And I hope it stays that way after I say what I'm going to say tonight, because I haven't visited a IOC meeting for quite a while because of the retaliation and moving around. And once I shut up and quit doing stuff, then I finally got left alone. Let's see if it stays that way. I sure hope it does. But they are charging us $15 for any more than 40 pages of IRs, grievances, and complaints for a disc, them being put on disc. Well, every time I got all my IRs, grievance with appeals from 2016 of December up to December of 2023. And there were 798 in 1 year IRs. They made frivolous things like the incident was I didn't take my Metamucil or I didn't test my glucose. That's an incident. You would think an incident would be somebody punching somebody or throwing something or screaming, yelling, not refusing to take their fiber powder. So that they're going to charge a lot of people money for frivolous things. The Arizona Administrative Code does read that visitation, mail, and calls are supposed to be confidential. Those are being all violated. This is a hospital. I'm on a unit. I love this unit. But they don't have basic medical necessities like medical tape, band-aids, ointment. I'm a diabetic and I have a really bad crack on my foot that's open and I don't want to lose my foot, but we went to put something on it tonight and there's Vaseline and there's nothing to hold it on with. I have to put my sock right over it. We have a food committee that just came last week or so. I don't know why they ever come because they never take any of our input or change the menu in 8 years I've been here, except to take things away like the hot dog and the taquitos because somebody chose. That's where what happens is we all get blanketed when one person has an incident, a real incident, and it's blanketed like the visitation. There's a big bay window in front of the room where the laptop is. The hospital and the state has spent millions and millions of dollars on all these high-tech cameras that hear and see down a dime, the date on a dime. Why aren't they watching them then? I should be. And one thing, I take a med called Suboxone or Subutex 1-2. It's a pill. I get 4 milligrams a day. The treatments for this pill read that it's for OUD, which is opioid use disorder, drug withdrawals, and pain.
Tim, that's out of time. And also, we can't discuss personal treatment.
Okay, I'm sorry. One thing, though, health disease never goes away. You're always going to be SMI, but only in remission with properly medicated, and the doctors here to ask will never say anybody's not dangerous or they're mentally fit because it's a meal ticket. And the blanketed is if I drive a car too fast and I accidentally kill somebody, is the United States going to take away the car from everybody? That's what get blanketed is. You're going to punish everybody for one person's mess up. Yeah, this is, and I would like to know if the body search is a standing order from now on. as a doctor's order, as a standing order, or do they have to individually get that in writing from Dr. Quo, as he's the minister, the doctor now, or is that a standing order for everybody, or for just people who have tested positive for illicit narcotics?
Thank you, Tim. Yeah. You know, we can't answer, but is there anyone else?
Yeah. A little bit of fast chew, you know, but I sure hope that I don't have retaliation for speaking my mind and speaking up for my rights and my peers' rights, because that's where I fear. And that's why I haven't came to a meeting in a long time and said anything, because that's what I don't want. Thank you.
Do we have anyone else? Anyone from the public that we have not heard from that would like to have a 3-minute? Okay, hearing none, do I have a motion to adjourn?
Motion to adjourn.
I second.
Okay. Anyone opposed?
7:14:54. Oh, sorry.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, everyone. I appreciate your service.
All right. Thank you. And Lori, I'll find out who the judge in Pima County is.
Thank you. Thank you, Kay.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Goodbye.
Thank you, everybody.
Bye.